This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. Polling this month has shown that President Trump's approval ratings are at an all-time low for either term, ranging from the mid-30s to the low 40s. And American dissatisfaction took to the streets Saturday, with more than 3,000 No Kings rallies across the country and across the globe. Abilene's event might look small compared to the huge crowds that showed up in major cities, but as KACU's Bailey Simon reports, the protest was bigger than the last two.
All right, when I say no, y'all say kings. No?
Kings.
No?
Kings.
When I say no, y'all say pedophiles running our country. No?
Two grassroots organizations, 50501 and Indivisible, worked together to organize the rallies across the country. They estimate as many as 8 million people participated. In Abilene, organizers say around 300 people showed up this time, more than the last two No Kings rallies, and that shows that frustration is growing, even in solidly Republican regions like West Texas. During the October rally, several Trump supporters stood across the street from the city hall in opposition to the No Kings message. This time, there was no opposing crowd. Charles Nall held a sign reading, "No War, No Terrorists, Follow the Constitution." He describes himself as an independent voter and says he actually voted for Trump in 2016.
I watch politics every day, and I see what he's doing. I mean, it's the authoritarian playbook, step one, two, three. And he's probably on 2.5, and I'm just, I'm tired of it. So it's very concerning. We've got grandkids. I'm concerned about the future of, the earth. I'm concerned about the future of the United States of America.
The demonstrators were motivated by a wide range of complaints, from the war in Iran to the Epstein files, immigration, and inflation. Diana Luna, who is running for Texas House District 71, says she supports the No Kings Day movement because it gives people a chance to express their First Amendment right to protest. She says she doesn't agree with any of the policies Trump has implemented to try to help the economy.
All they've done is make billionaires more. Billionaires richer and working class people, our groceries are still going up. Our gas prices are now going up in Abilene.
The conflict between the U.S. and Iran has put a standstill on the Strait of Hormuz, a vital waterway that handles about 20% of the world's oil supply. As a result, the national average for a gallon of regular gasoline has increased by about a dollar. Samuel Garcia, chair of the Taylor County Democratic Party, set up a table with a sign asking, "What is something you do that a billionaire wouldn't understand?"
They don't understand what we do every single day as regular Americans who suffer with our budget.
Garcia says people's answers to his question serve as a reminder to him of why he is passionate about working in politics.
So elections matter. Yes, I am a political animal. I have my whole life. I love politics. I really do. But why? Because I know it makes a difference in your everyday lives.
Through the whole rally, speakers emphasized the importance of voting and influencing others to make change happen. Linda Goolsby came to the rally as a Taylor County volunteer deputy registrar to help attendees go through the steps of registering to vote.
I am here because I am really concerned about the fact that all of a sudden we have a very non-constitutional semi-monarchy going on, and it's important to me that our democracy survive. That's the big statement. The place where we are right now is we are a democracy. People can vote and change things.
Protesters held signs reading, "Keep families together," and "For my father who came with nothing to give me everything," in retaliation to ICE raids and detentions. As of March 2026, 13 deaths in ICE detention have been reported this year. Rally attendee Billy Keith says he's not usually the type to go to protests, but felt that it was time he used his voice to make a difference.
Everybody wants all the criminals gone. They want the criminals, sent away, put behind bars. But folks that are over here to try to earn a living, to do better for themselves and their families, leave those people alone. Let them work. They're not hurting anybody.
For the protesters and speakers at the rally, accountability and justice go beyond getting Donald Trump out of office. They also want to see government officials involved in the Epstein files be held accountable for their criminal activity.
No kings, no cover-ups. No kings,
no cover-ups.
No kings,
no cover-ups.
Release the files, name the names.
Shelby Taylor spoke to the crowd about the impact that the lack of accountability has had on human trafficking survivors like herself.
Now imagine for a moment that you're a sexual assault survivor or the victim of the current president of the United States of America. Can you imagine what it must feel like to watch him give the State of the Union address, ramble on for hours on a global stage, while we sit here privately reliving each moment of our assault?
In October of 2025, President Trump called the No Kings protests a joke and said that the protesters were not representative of the whole country. Ahead of Saturday's nationwide rallies, the White House called them Trump derangement therapy sessions. For protesters, the Day of Action gave them the chance to join with millions of other Americans to peacefully exercise their First Amendment rights, to gather and to speak, delivering the overarching No Kings message that nobody is above the law. I'm Bailey Simon in Abilene.
The largest immigration detention camp in the nation has been open for about 6 months, and the demands to shut it down have only grown louder. There have been dozens of 911 calls from the facility in El Paso, Texas.
She's in and out of consciousness.
Okay, is she breathing?
Yes.
Okay. Has she had more than one seizure in a row?
Yes.
This was one of the calls about a person having a seizure. There were also suspected heart attacks, serious allergic reactions, and injuries. KTEP's Angela Kacherga obtained 2 months of emergency call recordings using the Texas Public Information Act and has this report.
El Paso 911, Operator Lerma, what's the address of your emergency?
Yes, here at Camp East, Montana, please. ICE facility.
During a two-month period at the ICE facility from December through January, there were about 50 calls for emergency services. Several involved people who are medically fragile.
We have a 80-year-old male that had a witnessed fall, and he hit his head.
The 80-year-old man slipped and fell in the shower.
Is he having any difficulty breathing?
No.
A couple of calls involved people with advanced cancer. And there was this pregnant woman.
She is 12 weeks pregnant, reporting lower back pain and severe headaches.
Human rights organizations, immigrant advocates, and lawyers with clients at the camp have documented cases of medical neglect at the tent facility, which usually has about 3,000 detainees.
Lo viví yo misma, con respecto a enfermarse.
Dulce, a 34-year-old woman, says she got extremely sick while detained for 5 months at the camp. I spoke to her recently after she was released with an ankle monitor. She requested we not use her full name because she's concerned talking to the media could affect her asylum petition. The mother of three says she's been in the country for nearly a decade and has a work permit. Dulce says she was bedridden for several days with a fever. There's a clinic on site, but detainees have to put their names on a waiting list to see a doctor, she said. She says drink more water was frequently the only medical advice for a host of health problems. It happened so often, she says, the women jokingly called it miracle water. The Department of Homeland Security, which oversees ICE, recently changed the private contractor operating the tent camp at Fort Bliss. In an emailed statement, DHS said it will work closely with the new contractor, Virginia-based Amentum, in implementing higher standards of medical care, more thorough case processing, and intake procedures.
I have long been worried about a public health emergency within the facility.
El Paso Congresswoman Veronica Escobar has toured Camp East, Montana several times since it opened last August. During a visit in late January, Escobar says she was warned to stay out of an area because of an outbreak of tuberculosis.
Oh, no, ma'am. You don't want to walk in there. No one in there has been tested for TB yet.
Escobar says she asked why none of the staff entering and leaving the area wore masks and was told using protective gear was a personal preference. There was also a measles outbreak in February. The calls to close the camp intensified after three people in custody died. DHS says two deaths are under investigation. Nationwide, more than two dozen people have died in ICE custody since October. Dulce says she's relieved she's been released and reunited with her family, but worries about the women still at the camp. Tears welling up in her eyes. She says there are people who also have families waiting for them on the outside. I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
Rural West Texas communities have a reputation for generosity. In Brownwood, that tendency for neighbors to help neighbors has taken on a bit of a flash mob style at a family-run produce market. KACU's Heather Claiborne has that story.
I think this is the most amazing thing that I have heard of in a long time.
Casey Harton was one of the dozens of people who lined up last Friday to get in on a giveaway at Sliger's Market in Brownwood. A couple of hours earlier, Cullen Sliger had posted on social media that local State Farm agent Matthew Williams was sponsoring a giveaway of eggs and strawberries starting at 3 o'clock. By 2:45, a line stretched across the parking lot and cars lined the small street.
We usually do eggs and potatoes, a staple, that way they'll have food. I didn't have a lot of help today, so we chose eggs and strawberries.
When 3 o'clock hit, Sliger's 11-year-old grandson, Ty Cross, and his friend Dean Potts began to hand a dozen eggs and a box of strawberries to each person in line.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
How are y'all?
Good.
Thank you. I appreciate you. Thank you so much. Thank y'all.
I think it's really cool to do stuff like this, and it's just fun to do.
Sliger's has done more than a dozen giveaways over the past couple of months. Owner Cullen Sliger says one act of generosity has inspired the next.
You know, when the government shut down and people didn't have food stamps, we started selling stuff real cheap. And then other people started saying, hey, I'll give you money, give stuff away. So they give me money and I just give stuff away.
Sliger's is a family business founded by Cullen's father in the 1950s. And he inspired Cullen's management of the business today and the ongoing generosity. Most of the giveaways have included more than a dozen eggs and a 50-pound box of potatoes per household.
My dad always said, if you had potatoes, you'd never go hungry. And we tried to make sure everybody gets potatoes. We've given away probably 12,000 pounds of potatoes in the last 2 months.
Casey Harton lives in nearby Bangs, probably too far to get to Sliger's before they run out, but she works down the street and came with a coworker. They say these giveaways are helping not just those hit by the government shutdown, but everyone who's feeling their budgets pinched.
I think it's incredible that businesses and Sliger's have gotten together to help the community out like this, with prices rising, gas rising, and it's hard to make ends meet. I think this is incredible.
And Harton says it does give her a good opinion of the sponsoring businesses. That list has included individuals and local businesses like El Nino Fencing, Aaron Cone Air Conditioning, Johnson Gunworks, and even Optimal MD out of San Antonio, as well as organizations like the International United Indigenous Nations and the Brownwood Municipal Police Association.
I was a little surprised. There was a good turnout today. It basically backed up, what, to the street, Dana?
Yeah.
Yeah, so good-sized crowd today.
It was chilly and very windy Friday. Isaac Bourbon and Dana Bryant came from Matt Williams State Farm Office to help the long line move quickly.
I mean, I really think this is a small way we can get back to our community in little separate ways. And obviously there's so many people that need help, and Matt's always ready to give it.
Well, I think it sets a good precedent for other, not just insurance businesses, but like small businesses. I think it shows that you're invested in the community, giving back, and hopefully other companies here, business owners, will follow suit and find ways to allocate goods like this to the community at large here in Brownwood.
The next day, Wells Custom Floors sponsored another giveaway. As the government shutdown continues with no end in sight, Cullen says he has a list of people who have signed up to be part of his market's crowdsourced grocery giveaways. And though the market is getting busier with shoppers coming in to buy vegetable and flower plants for their gardens, he'll keep hosting the giveaways as long as community members keep sponsoring them. And for their part, Sliger's grandson and his friend say they hope Bluebell Ice Cream will sponsor a giveaway. I'm Heather Claiborne in Brownwood.
International Prison Ministry Kairos works with volunteers to bring hope to men and women who are incarcerated. KACU's Bailey Simon has this look at the work being done by Kairos in the French Robertson unit and the surrounding Abilene areas.
Twice a year, the warden of Robertson Prison selects 42 men whom she feels would most benefit from the Kairos Inside program. Some inmates wait years to be picked, while others get picked the first time. Over the 3.5-day event, volunteers bring grace and love inside prison walls to engage inmates in deep conversation that they hope will instill a new sense of hope. Chris Cummings joined Kairos Inside as part of the worship team 13 years ago. Cummings says he was raised in an innocent Christian household, so the initial thought of serving in a maximum security prison was intimidating. Now, he says his 22 weekends in prison have been one of the biggest blessings of his life, and he loves the challenge of breaking through the prisoner's walls.
In prison, there's games going all the time, and so they're very skeptical of what you're doing. And why would these people come in from the free world and try to feed me and love on me and tell me about God? Why would they do that? There must be some alternative they're looking for.
The weekends start informally, with everyone receiving name tags and sandwiches. According to Cummings, around 90% of the men they interact with in prison have never had exposure to Christian activities of any kind. Often, a volunteer who was once in prison shares their story with inmates to build trust and credibility early on in the weekend.
Instantly, guys go, oh, wow, he's one of us.
While volunteers are making connections inside, another program focuses on supporting women who have family members or loved ones in prison. The most recent Kairos Outside weekends have been held in Luders, Texas, at the Big Country Baptist Assembly campsite. Dana Ross was part of the first Kairos Outside weekend in Abilene. In early May, the group will host its 16th weekend event. Like many inmates, not all of the women that Kairos Outside serves are familiar with Christianity. Ross says they want the women to feel like they belong, no matter their faith.
The talks just go from not so much talking about Christ to more of how Christ changes your life if you allow him to.
Participants on both sides receive a lot of food. Inmates receive brisket, hamburgers, chicken lasagna, fried chicken, and what Chris Cummings describes as an awesome amount of cookies.
My saying about Kairos is that we get to their stomachs and God gets to their heart.
The talks given by Kairos team members address the specific struggles that inmates and women affected by incarceration deal with. Inmates don't get to make many choices on their own. They are told when they can shower and when they can eat. Cummings says the Kairos Inside team focuses on teaching inmates the value of opening up and establishing friendships with the men around them. The challenges for women with husbands in prison are almost the opposite, having to make all the decisions for their family while working and raising kids without a partner. Mothers who have sons and daughters in prison struggle with not being able to care for them while they are away. Ross says the women also struggle to open up about their challenges.
They don't want anybody to judge them. You know, it's just really hard sometimes to admit, yeah, I'm part of that group, a group that you know, really don't want to be in, but you're in.
Some women sign up for the weekend but then don't show up, which Ross says is likely due to their social fears of judgment and rejection. Organizers say those who do participate often stay connected and continue to grow their connections and faith through SWAP group meetings. SWAP stands for Share, Witness, Accountability, and Prayer. Organizers of the Kairos weekends, both inside and outside, say it's not magic. But Chris Cummings says by the time the weekend wraps up, the Kairos Inside volunteers see a change in many inmates.
Sunday is the most powerful worship I've ever seen because these men are so full of joy. They have found freedom that they've never experienced in their life.
The work of Kairos Inside doesn't end once the weekend concludes. Once a month, inmates in the unit facilitate a meeting time for prayer and music. Volunteers can go out to participate, but it is primarily the inmates who lead. And there is data to show that the change the volunteers witness is not a trick or just an emotional high. Cummings says usually in any 100 people released from the Robertson unit, 55 of them are going to be back in that unit pretty soon. But for the men who go through Kairos, only 16 end up back in prison. Both Cummings and Ross say that they could always use more funding and volunteers looking to make a positive impact on their inmates, their families, and for communities. I'm Bailey Simon in Abilene.
There is more information about Kairos on our website, kacu.org. The story was reported in partnership with the West Texas Tribune. This is the West Texas Dispatch. We have another 40th birthday flashback to share. Throughout this year, we will be bringing you updates from our former hosts and reporters. Some of them have gone on to careers outside of journalism. Others have found interesting places to keep exercising the skill set they first developed in these studios. This week, we hear from Amber, then Chavez, now Heckler.
Hi, KUCU. This is Amber Heckler. You may remember me as Amber Chavez when I was an on-air host and producer from 2017 to 2019. Big congratulations to KACU for their 40th anniversary. My favorite memory as a host was, funny enough, learning how to speak less fast and more conversationally from my mentors Zane Goggins and Nathan Gibbs. And I remember getting a listener call correcting my pronunciation of Episcopal. Since graduating from ACU, I have developed deep friendships with incredibly talented journalists like fellow KACU alum Mercedes Hernandez. I loved meeting listeners during the monthly Coffee with KACU events, and my overall experience really taught me how to cherish the relationships with the people around me, especially when it came to appreciating life in West Texas as someone from a large and fast-moving city like Austin. The most impactful reporting that has stuck with me from my time in Abilene was the 2018 fire at the Abilene Reporter News Building. I remember standing on the roof of the Grace Museum with my video camera, capturing the heavy smoke billowing from the building, and later interviewing Reporter News staff, and those were core memories that have long fueled my passion for news. I've since transitioned from doing audio and visual news to writing for an arts and culture publication called Culture Map. I write about travel, real estate, restaurant openings, and so much more happening in the biggest metros in Texas. And I also get to spend time covering Austin events like South by Southwest and ACL Music Festival. And I wouldn't have this opportunity without my journalism experience at KACU. The world needs more people that are dedicated to telling the truth and sharing the lived experiences of others. And supporting local public radio also provides support for the student journalists that want to make a living doing what they love. Happy birthday, KACU. I wish you many more years of public support for the news you provide and the young journalists you create. I haven't said this in a really long time, so here goes. I'm Amber Heckler, and you're listening to KACU 89.5 Abilene.
Thanks to Amber and all of the KACU alumni who are helping us celebrate our 40th birthday. We'll have another flashback segment on next week's show. The Great Texas Birding Classic kicks off later this month. This is the 30th annual event, making it the longest birdwatching tournament in the country. We've asked Shelley Plant to tell us all about it. Shelley is the Nature Tourism Manager for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, as I just told her. A dream job, I think, for many of us. How great would that be? Shelley, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we mentioned this is the longest running birding event in the U.S. It's also the biggest. Who's it for? Who participates in this thing?
My quick answer is everyone should participate in this thing who loves the outdoors. There really is something for everyone. So even if you're just getting started at looking at birds, I think you'd find a tournament that would really fit your style. But if you've been doing this for decades or years and you're really avid, I think there's something for you too.
Today's that final day to register. What do people need to do to sign up for this thing?
The best thing to do is find a friend or two who's going to join you on your team. And then go online to birdingclassic.org and register your team and pay your registration fee, and you're in. You're good to go.
Okay, for those out there who have never birded, what are they going to be doing during this tournament?
You're literally going to be having the best day of your spring migration and going out and seeing birds and seeing what you hear, seeing what you see, and really just enjoying migration here in Texas. And you're going to be contributing to citizen science because you're submitting your checklist to a thing called eBird. You're going to be raising money for conservation because we are a cost recovery event. We donate conservation grants every year with the registration fees earned. And on top of all that, you're going to have a really good time with friends and get an amazing t-shirt for our 30th anniversary event.
I have a 15-year-old who would be very interested in this. Can kids get involved in this birding tournament as well?
Absolutely. We have youth tournaments where they can just participate with some of their buddies if they have any buddies also into birding. But if they want to be part of a family team, we have mixed age tournaments. So they could go out with mom and dad or grandma and granddad or their aunt and uncle or just a mentor from their school. So they could be on a team with adults or they could be on a team with their peers. Either way, we have a tournament category for them.
You guys have been doing this for 29 years. What has this tournament done for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department?
Well, not so much for the department, but for the state. We've donated almost $2 million to habitat conservation projects throughout the state to support birds and birders. So, I mean, it really is important at sites to have good places to walk and view and go to a wildlife viewing blind. We've funded a lot of those blinds. We've funded some of those boardwalks, some of that signage, habitat acquisition projects. So our real success is we're connecting over 1,000 people every year to nature through a birding tournament, which is really niche in and of itself. But then we're also raising money for really important habitat conservation in a state that really is part of the funnel of the flyways. We have so many birds that come through our state. So protecting habitat and giving them a safe place to land is really important.
It doesn't matter where you are in West Texas listening to this right now. There are birds, there are ways to get out there and see them. There are state parks, there are areas that you can go. You can get involved anywhere, can't you?
You can. And Far West Texas is so special because y'all get some of those vagrants from Mexico who come up. So there are birds that can be seen in West Texas that can't be seen anywhere else in the state. And some birds that y'all probably take for granted on seeing are really easy for you guys and other teams in other parts of the state would be salivating over the list that y'all can get in West Texas. You just have such great birding there.
Shelley, anything else we need to know about this tournament?
I think just know that it's fun. When you say a bird watching tournament, it can sound intimidating, but I don't think it should be. The quotes we get after people go out is like, this was such a fun adventure with my friends. This was what we love to do and look forward to every spring with my family. We got to see sites that we didn't even know existed in our own backyard, and it really opened our eyes to nature that we really took for granted. So I think you're going to have a winning experience, again, no matter how good a birder you are, because getting outside in nature is never a bad day. So step away from the office, step away from your computers, go spend a little time outdoors and really enjoy going birding with some friends and raising money for conservation.
Shelley Plant is Nature Tourism Manager with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Shelley, thanks for taking some time to talk to us on the West Texas Dispatch today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
The Great Texas Birding Classic will run April 15 through May 15. As we noted, today is the final day to sign up to participate. There is more information on the website, birdingclassic.org. It's time for West Texas Roots. We have a special twofer this week. Sometimes these stories make it difficult to separate folklore from fact, but in this case, we get the best of both worlds. First, we hear from Barry Johnson, who recalled doing chores for his grandma and a road trip to California. Then Darren Wright shares an interesting story on how families would hide in their basements during Native American raids together with their most valuable possessions, horses.
My grandma used to keep a bowl of unshelled black-eyed peas by the back porch, and you'd walk in the kitchen right there by the door, and she'd ask, did you shell any peas before you came in the house? And you better have her go pick a switch so I could whoop you some. No, it's from this big giant bush with little yellow flowers on it. Well, I learned over the years, I was one of the middle grandkids, what size to pick. Oh, it'd be about 4 foot long and about the size of a pencil. Well, I guess she wanted to make sure she could hit you if you started jumping around too much. Yeah, we did. We went to California once to visit her sister or cousin that lived, all I remember was they lived by the ocean and there was a big giant rock out there about where they lived, out in the ocean. It had a bench seat in the front. There'd be about 3 or 4 of us in the front seat, and depending on the size of the rest of them, there'd be 5 to, I don't know, a lot. They were crammed back there. Some people, if a lot of people, kids wanted to go, they sat in the floorboard back there. 55 Chevrolet four-door.
Mom would tell me about the people around where they live there in the Graham area. They always have a reunion there at Fort Belknap, but they would hide in the basements of the homes, and the basements were always deep enough to bring the horses in as well, because they would, you know, that was one of their big commodities, is the besides themselves, was the horses. And so they would take the horses down in the basement with them during the raids and hide down in there. And my nephew now is a police officer in Young County, and he has had the opportunity to see some of the sheriff books and read some of the old stories that were in the logs about things going on around in there, and he's found and tracked where family was at there, and has tried to go out and look at some of the places that Mom has described, and has found a few, but that's, you know, the basic of it. He gets into it more than I do. He's really into the, you know, tracing the history down there, but there's still a few family down there. And I've always been told that my grandmother had Indian blood in her, you know, some kind of heritage, but I never really got deep into tracking it down. But my mom would be the real one to tell all the stories about everything that went on and how they got by during that time.
We recorded Darren Wright's story about how families would hide their horses in their basement during Native American raids, and Barry Johnson's story of his grandma at the Taylor County Expo Center. This is the West Texas Dispatch. We're not quite done with West Texas history today. We wanted to tell you about an event coming up at the Merkel Area Historical Museum. KACU's Caleb Leger spoke with John Compare, a retired military lawyer and judge who's also been a guest columnist for several West Texas publications. Tomorrow night, Compare will share the story of Texas cattle drives at the Merkel Museum.
Once upon a time, spring in Texas meant it was time for cattle to head north. Can you give us a brief timeline and some context for spring cattle drives across the state?
Certainly. Remember that the Texas cattle drives lasted from 1866 to 1896, approximately 30 years. They happened right after the Civil War. So to put it in context, all of the men that were in the Civil War fighting for the Confederacy came home after the Civil War. The ones that survived came home. They had no jobs. A lot of young men, and they had no money. The money wasn't any good. The Confederacy money wasn't any good, so they came home broke, and they came home without jobs. And so that was basically the setting. And during the Civil War, down in South Texas near the Nueces River in the brush country down there called the Brasada, hundreds of longhorns were feral and wild, and they were running down there and breeding and multiplying, so they were all over this area. And after the Civil War, the North was out of beef. They didn't have any beef, and there was a huge demand. Texas knew that longhorns, these feral or wild longhorns down in the South Texas area, just roaming around down there free, were worth $4 a piece in Texas. But in the North, they were worth $40 to $50 a head. But they had to find some way to get them to the railheads, to the Midwest railheads in Kansas and up in there, to get them to the railheads so they could be transported north and sold. So an enterprising mule breeder and seller who had used the railroads to transport mules in the Midwest and the North decided to come down to Texas. He bought some land up in Kansas and convinced the railroad to take the railroad to his new little town. It was called Abilene, Kansas. It became one of the biggest cattle heads, shipping it north. So he came down to Texas and offered to pay the market price for beef. That's $40 to $50 a head in gold. And his name was McCoy. And he came down and advertised and talked the Texas people into gathering these feral longhorns in South Texas and taking them up to Abilene, Kansas, so he could put them on the railhead and ship them north. And he sold millions of cattle. And he paid in gold. And that's where we got the expression, it's the real McCoy. This guy's name was McCoy, and he promised to pay in gold. And when the first herds were delivered up there, he actually paid them $40 to $50 a head in gold. So it was called the real McCoy. So 10 million cattle and a million horses were taken to the Midwest and put on the rails to go north to the beef factories. And that's one of the ways Texas economically recovered from the Civil War. It was very successful. So that puts it in context generally at the time.
I'm sure many of our listeners have read or watched Lonesome Dove or any number of other movies that included cattle drive as a key part of the story. So how important are cattle drives in the history of the Lone Star State and specifically in West Texas?
Well, all of the cattle drives, as I mentioned earlier, originated by the Nueces River in the Brasada country down there. But there were three main. The Great Western Trail was the most active and had the most cattle, and it came right through Callahan County, came right through Baird, and then up to Fort Griffin, where feeder trails from Buffalo Gap through Abilene joined it, and then went on north to the railheads. You mentioned Lonesome Dove. Lonesome Dove was about the Goodnight Loving Trail. Goodnight Loving, one of the things the Goodnight Loving Trail did was it went west. It went west instead of north because there were hostile Indians in Oklahoma and in the plains. And so Goodnight Loving figured out if they would follow the old Pecos, the old Butterfield stage line, west into New Mexico, and then north up into Colorado and the railheads up there, well, they could bypass the hostile native attacks. So that's what Lonesome Dove was all about, was the Goodnight Loving Trail.
So you said that, you know, after the Civil War is when the cattle drives really started up. So what happened to them? When did they stop becoming common, and when did they really end?
It went for 30 years from 1866 to 1896. And it's very interesting on what stopped them. After 30 years, there were three factors that stopped them. The first thing were fences. That was one of the things that the barbed wire and ranchers started fencing in. So that hindered the trail drives and being driven. But also windmills, the steam engines. Remember back then, the railroad, the engines were steam engines. It required a lot of water. So once windmills were invented and developed and placed around here, then the railroad could come in and put its lines in and stop and get fill up with the steam engines. So railroads, windmills, and barbed wire fence is what stopped the trail drives.
Is there something that you identify as a lasting legacy of the Texas cattle drives?
Well, the one of the things that we have now, and that just happened in, I'd say, the last 10 or 15 years, is those permanent Bliss granite markers that the Great Western Trail has put from Matamoros, Mexico, all the way to the Canadian border, every place that the trail herds went through. There's also a granite monument at Frontier, Texas, outside by the parking area that was placed there by the Great Western Trail and the International Rotary Club, because a feeder trail from the Buffalo Gap area came through Abilene and into Fort Griffin and joined the main herd to go north.
I'd just like to thank you, Mr. Compeer, for joining us at the West Texas Dispatch.
Caleb, it's my pleasure. I enjoyed visiting with you.
That's KACU's Caleb Leger speaking with John Compare about Texas cattle drives. You can hear more about this topic 6 p.m. tomorrow night at the Merkle Area History Museum. This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. Plan to join us and tell a friend. By the way, if you ever miss a show, well, you can always play catch up and find an older show. West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can find it on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, as well as producers Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger, and our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. Special thanks to J.C. Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.